Hi, I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 213 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to throw us some support and help keep this thing going, as Matthew Krasnowski just did, please go to caropop.com. Thanks, Matthew. This week's guest is a percussionist and drummer who has turned in indelible work with Tom Waits, Elvis Costello, Lou Reed, and more. Michael Blair. Like recent guest Mark Rebo, Blair had a professional breakthrough on Tom Waits' 1985 album Rain Dogs and went on to perform with Elvis Costello. That's Blair providing the spooky marimba on Waits' Clap Hands and providing head-spinning percussion throughout Rain Dogs. A year later, Blair was playing the main riff to Elvis Costello's cover of Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood on marimba. Blair has a story of how that came to be, as well as why Costello's voice sounds so rough on that recording. I saw Blair perform live with Costello twice, at the last Confederates show of their 1986 U.S. tour, and as part of the Rude Five on Costello's 1989 tour, supporting the album Spike. Here's what Blair is credited with playing on that album. Glockenspiel, marimba, tambourine, xylophone, bells, timpani, vibraphone, Chinese drums, Oldsmobile hubcap, parade drum, anvil, whiplash, crash box, temple bells, snare drum, magic table, metal pipe, and Martian dog bark. As he relates here, Blair also enjoyed the thrill of playing alongside Roger McGuinn of the Byrds on This Town. Something about the Blair tells of the circuitous way he became the drummer on Lou Reed's 1992 album, Magic and Loss. Wait, the drums on that album were recorded how? Blair had creative collaborations with singer-songwriter Sam Phillips and producer Hal Wilner as well, and he played drums on the Replacements album, All Shook Down. Now Blair lives and works in Stockholm, Sweden. How did he get there? How did that circuitous road take him from California through the University of Illinois, a Steppenwolf theater production, and many more fascinating stops? His career has been an ear-opening adventure. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Michael Blair. You're my second musician in Stockholm.
I saw that you had spoken with Jonathan.
Right. You guys know each other?
Yeah, I've met him. I've never been in that world, but the whole Cracker Beethoven thingy. I mean, I'm a fan of theirs, and I like Jonathan's musicianship. So it's nice to have another kindred spirit in Stockholm.
Yeah, it seems like you guys would have complementary skills as well. You know, you both play a lot of different things, and they're not the same things.
Exactly. We just make stuff up, and sometimes people like it. We do anyway.
So how did you end up there?
Oh, by love. My beautiful Swedish partner, wife, we met in the summer of 87. She had lived in New York for a number of years, and I knew a lot of the people that she had known then. And she was on a holiday summer of 87 with some of those same friends. And then I was playing at a little bar, the Speakeasy, I think it was, on McDougal Street or something like that. And a couple of her friends were involved as well. So long story longer, she just came to the gig as part of her vacation and we met. And then a few months later, I was on the road with Waits and we were playing for a week almost in Stockholm. That was November of 87. So we got together officially that week and we've been together for 38 plus years. So yeah, it's a real love story, an honest to goodness one.
Wow. So how long have you actually been based in Stockholm then?
Well, since the late 80s, actually.
So really all that time.
Yeah, I mean, we got together as a couple and we were really serious from the beginning. So it wasn't like, is this going to be a relationship and what do we do next and blah, 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 blah. It wasn't like a dating over the Atlantic kind of thing. But I still had an apartment in the Lower East Side, so I kept that for a number of years because I was going back and forth. I was staying here in between gigs, but I was playing with Elvis and I was playing with Lou and then going back and forth and doing projects in London and other places. So this was my heart base but my business base was like London and New York mostly.
Right. Well, yeah, and I saw you twice with Elvis. I saw you on the Confederates tour in 86, the fall of 86.
Wow,
I was actually
that?
At the, oh my God, I was such a huge fan of that. And I actually was at the last stop of that tour. Pretty sure it was at the Tower Theater in Philadelphia.
Right, that sounds familiar.
And that was I saw all three nights of that tour then in 86. And then
'cause that was with the big wheel with the right, the lotto, the lottery song.
Yeah, the spinning songbook.
The spinning songbook
was one night. One night was just kind of the straight blood and chocolate tour, attraction show.
Right.
And then one night, I think the first night was like a 3-hour Confederate show. And I think it was the last one of the tour. And I was in Philadelphia at the time.
Oh, that's well.
And it was just,
good
I just
on
remember,
you.
I remember just went, you know, but I loved King of America. And then,
yeah, I mean, the thing with me and Elvis, I mean, he had been a Tom Waits fan, so I came in at the end of King of America because they were going to do he and T-Bone Burnett were working up a cover of Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, you know, the Animal song.
Right.
So it was actually after a Waits concert in Los Angeles, and they both asked me, said, you know, come to the studio the next day and do like the marimba and percussion overdubs on that song. So I did. And then Elvis, he had a cold, so we did a guide vocal. And so that's what we did. We did me and then the guide vocal, you know, for that track that day. But then he and T-Bone went back, you know, through the tracks and all that other stuff. And Elvis said, I can't beat that. You know, so that's the, you know, Elvis with a cold is the track that's on that.
He's got such a raw quality to his voice on that track. So when you said he had a cold, I'm like, I wonder if that's the one they kept, because it's like, it's really intense, actually.
Well, maybe he's channeling, you know, the animals and Eric Burdon and all that kind of stuff, and having a cold. But anyway, because of that, when they put the, when he and T-Bone put the King of America band together, they were nice enough to include me because everybody else had played more on the album, you know, than I had. But I was sort of in the family anyway. But I was very happy to bring the spling and splong and of course pinch myself turning around every night playing in front of Jim Keltner. So, you know, I was a pretty happy boy.
So the marimba on Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, did they say, hey, we want you to play marimba, or did you come up with that part?
Well, I mean, I came up both. So there was a marimba that was brought in because I had been playing a lot of marimba and mallets and stuff on the Waits stuff, which they liked. So that was the main idea, to have the marimba actually play the lick.
Right. Whichever one knows.
Yeah, Mitchell Froom had already put that down on organ, and Jerry Schaff was on acoustic bass, and Keltner was on drums on the track, and T-Bone had played guitar. So it was all there. And they wanted me to sort of glue Mitchell's thing together with, you know, the famous lick and all that other stuff. And then I scraped a bunch of stuff in the refrains to make it more noisy and did what I usually did. But yeah, so they wanted me to play that instrument, but then I made up the spot based on Mitchell's organ play.
So just to back you up a bit, you've played percussion live and on record a lot, and you've played drums as well. What was your background? Like, how did the sort of percussion and drums thing happen for you?
Good question. I'm an honest-to-goodness 70s university-trained percussionist, you know, with a degree in performance in orchestra and opera and conducting and avant-garde music and tabla and gamelan and, you know, the whole mid-70s world music percussion world. You know, so I got my degree. I went to two different colleges. And in California, I studied with Mitchell Peters, who was the principal percussionist for the Los Angeles Philharmonic. So I went to a small college east of Los Angeles, and I studied with Mitchell. And then I went to a bigger school south of Chicago. The University of Illinois. You know,
you
in Champaign-Urbana, you know, just south of you. You know, so I was there for years as well. And that actually had one of the most, and still has, one of the most important sort of like legacy from the 50s on percussion performance diplomas. So I was really happy to do that. So I had played the Harry Parts instruments, you know, I'd studied a lot of the things, you know, that helped me when, you know, I was in New York all those years, and composers enjoyed those kinds of, you know, from the world music to the junkyard thing, to throwing the things down the stairs, to Harry Parts, to John Cage, you know, and being like a Ringo Charlie Watts drummer, you know, since I was a kid, you know, so, you know, put those things together, and then it seemed like I came up with something that was useful.
Where did you grow up, and what was the first instrument you picked up?
San Diego, California, born, military family. My father was in the Navy. So we moved. I lived in San Diego 4 different times. And my dad worked at the Pentagon, and we lived in Rhode Island and North Carolina, South Carolina, and Southern California a number of times. And my first instrument was accordion. I was 7 when I started playing the accordion. I think I was in Lakewood, California, close to LA. And I was thinking I wanted to play the clarinet because I loved the sound when I was a little kid. But then, as would happen in the 60s, music teachers from the local music store would actually go into the neighborhoods and knock on doors. You know, I was like, do you want to take lessons? You know, do your kids want to take lessons at the local music shop? And then when that happened, I was 7, and the teacher that came was the accordion teacher.
Wow.
From that store. And I was like, wow, there are all these notes, and it's on your body, and it vibrates, and it's incredible. So I went, okay, I'll start with accordion. So I did that for about 4 years, and then started playing drums when I was 10, 11.
What was it that drew you to the drums?
As I was playing accordion, that was like then the early 60s. And then it was Motown, the Four Seasons, beginning of the Beach Boys, you know, what ended up being a lot of pop music that I really was influenced by. And the LA, you know, multi-percussion, you know, arrangements and film scores and stuff. And then, of course, the Beatles, you know, on Ed Sullivan in February 1964. And I was like, okay, that's what it's going to be.
But it was like it was Ringo you were watching and not John or
basically,
George.
Yeah. And the year before when, I mean, this is sort of nerdy stuff, but you're really good at that.
No, we're totally nerdy. This is what it's all about. This is Nerd Central.
Well, I still have my copy of the VJ version of Introducing the Beatles. The non-bootleg, and in England it was the Please Please Me album, but I got it in the American version. Well, VJ, right, another Chicago connection,
absolutely,
because they were from there, and so I still have that. So I was listening to Anna and Chains and Twist and Shout and all that other stuff. So I had already been in that world. I started learning Beatles songs on the accordion. I got a practice pad and started going like bloop 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 bloop. But then, yeah, when it looked like the Beatles were going to hit, that was over. Then, for better or worse, I let go of the accordion. And also, it was the money and the lessons and two different instruments and stuff. So, I just thought, like everybody else, I want to be Ringo now.
when you're learning accordion as a kid, are they teaching you, like, polkas, like sort of Mexican, you know, folk music? Like, what are you?
Well, it's funny that you ask that, because that's a really good question. I wish, as I got older and understood more of the accordion's background and Bulgarian polkas and the beginning of, well, what was it? It was dance music. It was the bandoneon in Argentina. It was the type of instruments that were in like Creole and bands and stuff like that in New Orleans, you know, and used as sort of like in the blues area. I wish I'd learned that, but I was playing like, what was it? What was Dominique, the sisters, the French singing group from the nuns, you know, the Catholic nuns, you know, it was a big hit. And so I was getting, my teachers were giving me like sheet music from like pop hits and stuff, you know, from the radio. So I was learning, and it was a full bass, you know, 120 bass on the one side and the keyboard on the other side. So it was almost as big as I was. But I loved it. The sound was great. And no, so actually I wasn't into the world ethnic background of accordion until I got older.
Yeah, I just had no idea sort of what do you teach someone when you're teaching someone accordion. But yeah, certainly you're watching Ed Sullivan show and you're seeing these guys up there with their guitars and bass and drums. And you're like, well, that looks a little, you can have a feature in that and you're not schlepping around these things as big as you are.
Well, little did I know.
Oh, the drums are actually like not light. So I take that back, actually.
Well, in the late 70s, I ended up having, like fusion and Stuart Copeland disease and all that other stuff. So I ended up with like a 13-piece set, that I would have in my apartment and bring down to the taxi and to go to a gig that didn't pay any money, in New York and stuff like that. So, yeah, years of therapy and chiropractors.
Well, to go from, Ringo, Charlie Watts, that pretty spare driving in the groove sound to the wide range of percussion stuff that you've played, including in school, how did you, what was that, progression for you? How did you get from one to the other?
Well, one of the things that made that happen was studying the multi-percussion in Southern California, like in Los Angeles and at Johnston College in Redlands, California. I was, and also I think our age group, so everybody that I was either studying with or playing with, including the faculty, we were in orchestras and opera ensembles and chamber music ensembles, but also played rock music and jazz on the weekends, with faculty bands and cover bands and all that stuff. So especially, since I was in my 20s, late teens, early 20s in college, I was of the generation that I wanted to play rock drums in bands and also study the other stuff, it was after Miles went electric. It was the beginning of fusion with Mahavishnu Orchestra and Chick Corea's Return to Forever and the beginning of the reggae, the Island Records stuff, would come. And then also the Nonesuch Records stuff would come from Bali and Java with all of these amazing, like Monkey Chants and Gamelan Records, So anyway, again, it's sort of a long answer, but almost everybody I knew in my generation, we played all that stuff. If we could study with a hand drummer from West Africa while we were in school and then learn how to play that, we did. And then there was a gamelan orchestra at Oberlin College, and we knew those people. So anyway, yeah, I never gave up the drums. I started learning drum kit when I was 10 or 11 and took lessons all the way through high school. So when I started the percussion degree, I kept on playing drums, so it was natural for me to do both.
Right. There are people who, they learn drums and then they get into these garage bands and then, stop going to school and they just become the drummer for their garage band. And sometimes that turns into something, amazing. And sometimes it stays as your little garage band that's just fun. But you went at it where you really learned it and you did this in school. And so it's like sort of a different level where it seems like you're exposed to so much more than, if you just done your little garage band on the side.
Well, it's true. Of course, if your little garage band, ends up being, the Sex Pistols or REM or something like that, then you're really, really happy to be in a garage band like that. But I know what you mean, though. Like a lot of my schoolmates, I really wanted to be in Weather Report. It was like 74 to 77 or actually 72 to 77 when I was in college. And me and 10,000 other percussion majors all over the world really wanted to be Alex Acuna, or Manolo Badrena, or, the percussionists that were playing with Miles, Ayerto, and all that sort of stuff. And they all played drum kit as well, all of them.
Oh, interesting.
So for me, I first heard of Alex Acuna when he was playing percussion on Black Market or something, with Weather Report. And then he graduated to playing drum set on Heavy Weather, and then they brought in another percussion player. And I was thinking, like, wow, that was like a Ringo moment for me. I was thinking, I might be able to do both of those, not necessarily that I was good enough to work with Joe Zawinul, but the sounds, combining those kinds of things. I was like, well, if they can do it, if I work hard enough and learn hard enough and get that experience, I might be able to combine, those sounds as well.
So at what point did you end up on the East Coast then?
Right. I was working on my graduate work at Illinois. I was working on a master's to get in percussion performance. And then my teacher recommended me for an audition. He had a former student who was playing with a band called the Paul Winter Consort. And then they were well known in the world music, improvisational, quasi-classical, you know, acoustic fusion. You know, they were in the middle of that. And actually the people that were in the original band was Ralph Towner and Colin Walcott and the people that ended up creating the band Oregon, you know, and I was a big fan of that, of them. So anyway, I got the audition. I got to audition for the Paul Winter Consort and I got the gig. So they were based in, Paul had a, and still has, I think, a million years later, a big farm in Connecticut, and then half the band was living in New York. So I took the gig and I moved to New York. That was the summer of 77.
So how much of your time did you spend in that band, and you know, how much kind of studio work and, you know, playing with other people did you do?
I spent a lot of time in that band because it was a great experience. I was 22, 23 when I was in that band. And so I was the kid in the group, but they were really successful all over the college circuit, you know, in the United States. So we toured a lot, you know, so for that year plus that I was in the group, we were on the road quite a bit. But I was also, to pay the bills and to meet people in New York, I was also accompanying modern dance classes for choreographers and also teaching music for dancers at two different colleges. So I was on the faculty of a couple colleges, Sarah Lawrence and Hunter College in New York, and then also I'm working with choreographers and playing hand drums and singing and, you know, for dancers, for dance classes a couple times a day when I was in town. So and also, just to follow that, I ended up meeting more musicians that I've ended up having relationships with for like 50 years now through the modern dance scene, because so many people were composing for dance, composing for new music and avant-garde ensembles, and I met a lot of people through that, actually.
Yeah, what was it like just being in New York after, again, coming from the West Coast, being in the Midwest, mm-hmm. Now you're in New York. Were you just like exposed to that many more musicians than you had been ever before?
Basically, yeah. I mean, I'm a little on the social side, so when I was studying in Southern California and then in Illinois, I was meeting everybody anyway, and I was playing as much as I could, and I was joining all these ensembles and playing with the faculty, but I brought that sort of, you know, I'm an ex-Navy brat. I can talk to anybody about anything.
Right.
You know, so I brought that to New York, and that helped.
How did you get connected with Tom Waits?
It was a number of years later, so it was the mid-80s by then. And I had heard him in the 70s when he was playing solo and was interested in the records. And, of course, Swordfish Trombones, you know, with Victor Feldman, you know, playing the avant-garde percussion and stuff. It was one of the most amazing things I'd ever heard. So I was working on a Buddy Holly project off Broadway. And the guitar player in that group, Bob Musso, was also a well-known downtown avant-garde world music recording engineer. He was an engineer. And he got the gig to do what ended up being Rain Dogs. And through his engineering, you know, connections. And then, so he recommended me to Tom and Kathleen. It was like the beginning of the summer of 85. And then also, I found out later that the production assistant working with Chris Blackwell and Tom and Kathleen also had me on a list, because there were people from the Lounge Lizards, you know, like, you know, you just talked to Mark Rebo, and there were other people, you know, that had played with Tears for Fears and Brian Eno and David Byrne, and, you know, so it was like the usual suspects of the downtown scene, and we were all on lists to, you know, to sort of come in and play for Tom. And then I got a call from the Island Records person, you know, saying that Bob had also recommended me. So I had all my stuff brought in the next day, And I opened up all my flight cases. You know, so there were three different drum sets. One that was actually my Ringo kit from 1965, the Ludwig Super Classic, and 40 different cymbals, 10 of which were broken, Japanese gongs, Chinese cymbals, and wood blocks and all kinds of other stuff, which I knew Tom would love.
Yeah.
So because we had never met before, you know, so there I am, I'm recommended. And before I even play anything, I go, come on out, here's what I got. And he was very happy.
Yeah, was he impressed with everything that you had him? He must have been like, happy.
Well, he was actually. I mean, I think looking back on it, I mean, Stephen Hodges was playing really, really great drums on a lot of Swordfish trombones. And then he was in the first Rain Dogs band. So he was involved in a lot of that. But he wasn't necessarily playing multi-percussion. And Tom had Victor Feldman, the amazing, you know, late, great, legendary session player from Los Angeles, do all that ethnic-y, world music-y stuff. So I think he got happy to see that I could do both. And I could also do both at the same time. I could set up a drum kit that had some of those things in it. You know, so working on basic tracks and stuff, we could just go.
Do you remember the first track that you did for that record with them?
Yes, Big Black Mariah. So the basic track had already been done. They had done it the day before. And then, you know, Tom, you know, said, what would you do with this? And I got out one of my broken cymbals. I mean, Stephen's drumming was great, and it all sounded really good. And I think it was before Keith put his guitar on. But anyway, I got out one of my best broken Chinese cymbals and just banged it on some of the backbeats. And like, that's all I did. But it made the drum kit sound so good, and that clang, you know, was working with Tom's guitar. And, you know, and if I remember correctly, then I came in to the control room after doing that overdub. And I'm pretty sure that Tom looked at me and he said, that's it, you're in.
So that was like your tryout.
There was a tryout, absolutely. You know, and I think I'm hoping that my memory is such, or romanticizing it, that he saw that I could play either make a really simple decision that would make a track more interesting, or I could have lots and lots and lots of ideas that he could then choose from. If you understand what I mean.
Yeah. I, the sort of the restraint you probably showed, the restraint you showed probably impressed him, because a lot of people would want to be like, look at all I can do. And you were just like, this is what's right for the song. And he knew if you were putting the song first, then he was in good hands.
Well, as usual, you just said it a lot better than I did. So
well, I wasn't there, so I'm no, glad but you expressed it. So I'm just interpreting it. But that sounds very cool. And then, so like a song like Singapore,
right?
Like, are you there later for the basic tracks, or are you sort of doing stuff after the fact for, you know, much of the album?
There were only, not only, but two tracks sort of had the basic tracks during those first couple of days. You know, so I did some overdubs on those, and then everything else, including Blind Love and Lay Down Your Head and all every Bride of Rain Dogs and all that other stuff that was done. I was on the tracking. We did everything. Gun Street Girl was done. If I remember correctly, I had the Chinese Tom Tom, one of the pieces of metal, and Tom played banjo and sang the song. And that was the basic track. And then everything else, the bass and the layers of percussions and stuff, that all happened later. So anyway, yeah, I was. It was me in the band with Steven and then Mark, and we were the house band for the record.
And from just talking to Mark Rebo recently, it sounds like Tom Waits gave you a fair amount of leeway to just play the song, as opposed to him coming in and saying, no, this is what your part should be.
He would never really say this is what the part should be. But sometimes he really would go, well, it sort of feels like this, and I'm looking for, you know, nighttime and you know the story, there's no beat on this one, so can you find some sounds, you know, that sound like you're in a haunted house? And you know, so there would be some kind of coaching, you know, coaching sure. as far as like the theater goes. And so yeah, in that way we were lucky. We were very lucky. But on the other hand, just like that Peter Gabriel quote, if I remember correctly, the worst thing in the world to give an artist is complete control or all of the options, because then like what are the 50,000 things that I can think of do you want, you know? And then with me and Mark, it would really be like, okay, this is a little harder feeling, this can be softer, you know, that kind of thing. I'm paraphrasing him,
right?
It wasn't like he didn't say anything. He never said do whatever you want. That's the thing, the Peter Gabriel quote, the worst thing in the world to tell an artist is to do whatever they want.
There you go.
You go right to therapy after that, your head's going to explode.
So when you're the percussionist and there's another drummer, mm-hmm. I would imagine that whatever the drummer's doing is going to have a pretty big effect on what you're going to do. Is a lot of your job to sort of work around, you know, and find the spaces that are there, you know, given what, you know, the main drummer is doing?
That's a really good way to put it. Yeah, when I've been doing sessions and I wasn't the drummer and I was coming in to do either, in a live percussion to find the groove or after the fact. Yeah, I mean, which frequencies, which kinds of openings of the sound, whether it's metal or string or wood, you know, would make it. And not to get the egg shaker out and go like, okay, no, I'm going to be like a Latin kind of, you know, shaker kind of guy. I mean, I never thought that way. But to follow your logic, absolutely. It's like what frequencies are left, you know, from where the kit is tuned. And then also, what kind of pick noise is on the guitar? You know, how much sibilance is there in the singer's voice if I'm doing overdubs after the vocals are on? So it's usually, for me, it's absolutely, like you said, finding the groove that the drummer's explained, you know, on the track. But then also there are two or three other instruments and the vocal, if I'm lucky. You know, to be able to go, okay, here are melodic things that can work. Here's some of the clank and crunch stuff that can work. Or I should just stay the hell out of the way, like you said.
Right. Well, and on Rain Dogs, Stephen Hodges is playing drums for a bunch of it and right. playing percussion, obviously. But you're also the main drummer on, what, I think three of the songs, including Hang Down Your Head. So is that right. like a different assignment then when you're actually the main drummer on those?
Yep, absolutely. And I would look at the drum kit almost like a percussion kit anyway, sort of like low, middle, and high, the bass drum and the snare drum and the tom-toms and as few cymbals as possible, because they would get in the way of the guitar sounds and the vocals. So I would play as few cymbals as possible and then also turn the snare off from the snare drum quite a bit, because lots of times, unless it's like a real sort of like groove, you know, like Motown R&B kind of thing, that sound isn't necessarily necessary, you know, so it can sound like a bunch of tom-toms then, you know, instead of hi-hat, snare drum kind of thing. So absolutely, I would make those decisions. Absolutely.
Right. Did you have a preference then for whether you were playing drums as well as percussion or just doing one instead of, or the other?
No, absolutely no. Nothing felt better than the other. I would, part of me was just pinching myself going, I get to play on all these songs. I get to play anything that I can on any of these songs, because Tom would bring in a song every morning and play it to us either, you know, from on the piano or the pump organ or his guitar or on a cassette. And he would go, this is the song we're going to work on today. And then, you know, it was sometimes Stephen, lots of times me and Mark, Larry Taylor played bass on a lot of it. Greg came in and played a lot of bass. So yeah, it was who's in the room and gets to start to build up the song.
Do you see your work on that album as being sort of a breakthrough for you in terms of getting you to the next projects, the next level, all of that?
Oh, absolutely. It is my milestone. It is the career changing, you know, summer, you know, and even in New York, I mean, when Mark and I ended up being like in the band, you know, from Tom and Kathleen's point of view. Then the word got around town. The word got around New York. You know, it's like Mark and Michael have joined, you know, they're working on the Rain Dogs thing, and Tom's putting a new band together and they're in it. You know, so in my teaching, I do a lot of coaching and teaching and you know, working with younger, you know, college age, you know, music students. And even now, you know, I'll say my version of that as a sort of a coaching thing is the day before I went to the studio to work with Tom, I was an interesting one of a million New York percussion players. You know, the day afterwards, I was Tom Waits' percussionist.
Right.
Completely, you know, completely night and day. And as it turns out, we were lucky, not lucky, because the songs were so great. But it still ends up on people's, you know, favorite records. You know, I'm working on some projects here, you know, in Stockholm with, you know, building some new projects that don't really have names yet anyway. But part of the reason that I'm even being involved in these projects was a record like Rain Dogs has stayed in people's memory. You know, and what it must have taken for Tom to write the songs and for us to come up with those parts shows how creative someone can be, you know, if you're lucky. And it was a popular album. So, you know, it was a pretty important record for Tom and Kathleen as well.
Yeah, and it was a popular album because it sounded unique. It sounded like it was its own thing, as opposed to popular albums that sound like other stuff. This was like, oh, this is like this thing I didn't know that I needed in my life, and this is so cool. You know, I need to listen to this all the time, you know, and it became the thing that people were forever comparing. So, oh, that sounds, you know, that sounds influenced by Tom Waits. It wasn't like Rain Dogs was like, oh, that's kind of X plus Y plus Z. It was like, no, that's Rain Dogs. That's Tom Waits. And you and Mark Rebo, it seems like it propelled like everyone involved in that album.
Right. Greg Cohen, you know, had moved to New York. You know, he had started working with Tom in Los Angeles. And actually at the time he was married to Tom's wife's sister. And Larry Taylor was still in Canned Heat. And, you know, so, you know, who was going to be in the touring band, you know, for the record. And that became Greg and me and Mark, you know, as the rhythm section. And yeah, so everybody, Greg went on, you know, to do decades worth of projects with people like, you know, with John Zorn and Laurie Anderson and like Mark has done. And so everybody got found. We got heard. And also, when we were doing some of the project, some of the concerts and stuff, Sting would come. You know, the Sting was there when we played at the Folies Bergère in France. And then, you know, when we were on Broadway, well, it's like, who's in the VIP section? Well, it's Bette Midler, you know, Mark Knopfler, you know, David Bowie and David Byrne, you know, in New York. And then we would come and play at the Olympia, you know, in Dublin. And it's like, well, who's in the VIP section? Well, you too. And so, or the Pogues. You know, so we ended up getting heard and appreciated by a lot of people. That was pretty wild.
There
we were
go.
Lucky.
So did you and Mark sort of go as a package deal over to Elvis at that point, or how did that happen?
Well, not a package deal. Well, sure. Actually, the short answer could be yes. Partly because Mark and I had a thing that sounded the way it sounded with Tom. And Elvis also knew that Mark could play R&B and funk, and he was studying classical, you know, Spanish guitar, and he had that sort of like spling splong, you know, like that sort of edgy distorto sound, you know, on his Telecasters. And, you know, so like when we end up working on Spike, you know, the Elvis's, you know, album, we were brought in together. We were absolutely brought in together. We were on a lot of that tracking. Absolutely.
So yeah, and a lot of the same songs.
So who brought you into
Spike?
T-Bone and Elvis. Because the King of America thing went pretty okay. And Elvis and I kept in touch, and I'd worked on some other stuff, and we knew a lot of the same people. So when they were putting Spike together, Elvis and T-Bone called me up and said, we want you to be in the house band and work on the arrangements, because they knew I'd done, you know, the sort of multi-percussion orchestra meets world meets drum kit kind of stuff, you know, that partly with Tom, but not to sound like Tom. So they called me up and said, you know, here's what we're going to do. And then they started sending me the cassettes, which included, because they wanted me to start working on arrangements before we even went to Los Angeles to go work on the record. So they sent me the cassette, you know, that actually was the Paul McCartney, you know, Elvis Costello songwriting cassette.
Oh, nice.
You know, with a lot of those songs, because three of the songs from that cassette ended up on the record, on Elvis's record, Spark.
Veronica, Pads, Paws, and Claws, and I'm trying to remember.
This Town? Was the other one? I mean, Paul played bass on This Town.
Right.
But then, right, exactly. I mean, you're, as usual, you're good at that stuff. With Flowers.
Nerd Central, I'm telling you.
It's great, which is why you're. I mean, this is fantastic.
Thank you. Shucks.
And then with, what was it, Flowers in the Dirt? You know, for Paul.
Right.
He had My Brave Face and So Like Candy, I think.
No, Elvis got So Like Candy for Mighty Like a Rose. Paul had You Want Her Too, which is not, you know.
Oh, that one. Right, exactly.
So, Veronica, Pat's Paws and Claws. Those are the only two McCartney ones on Spike. I'm looking.
You know, that they wrote together. I still have that cassette. You know, it's one of those great ones that I'll never sell on eBay or give to anybody else. I mean, but then T-Bone and Elvis sent me the other songs as well. You know, from God's Comic and the other stuff and the stuff that we were going to do in New Orleans with the Dirty Dozen Brass Band and Alan Toussaint. So I started working on the arrangements on those before we went to New Orleans.
Right. So like Let Him Dangle, you know, Mark's playing that, you know, very, you know, twangy, you know, guitar. And then you're credited as Chinese drum and Oldsmobile hubcap.
Yep. Well, there you go. I mean, that's exactly what I was playing. Elvis thought that was sort of funny, you know, because, I mean, he knew what was in all those boxes, you know, from the Tom Waits records and stuff.
So did you come up with that before you went into the studio? Like you brought the hubcap and all that?
Yeah. I mean, I had the stuff shipped out there and I would usually start someplace well along in my editing process, if you understand what I mean. You know, it wasn't like, okay, open up my boxes and let's see what's going to happen. It's like, no, on this kind of groove at this tempo with these kinds of frequencies, I'll already have picked out like two or three or four of the main instruments for my little world. And then I would start building from there. It didn't always work out, but I would really start from someplace.
Nice. So yeah, and you're on a lot of that record. I mean, was it enjoyable for you? I mean, was Elvis like, did he edit you or did he say, oh no, that's right, this is good?
It was pretty much most of the stuff that I gave him and T-Bone, they kept, if that makes sense, you know, from like a tracking arrangement overdubbing point of view, you know, there wasn't a lot of stuff where they had to go, well, no, what else do you have? You know, so like on God's Comic and stuff, when I layered the mallet instruments and the metals and the woods and the brushes on the snare drum, that was pretty much all in one piece.
God's Comic, I see you down as xylophone, marimba, snare drum, and magic table.
Yep. So we, with the drum programmer and T-Bone and Kevin Killen, the engineer, and Elvis and I, I would be involved most of the tracks that were all that were done in Los Angeles anyway, as the sort of house band, you know, building the basic tracks, doing the original programming, which almost all got replaced. But we knew we had already picked the tempos.
Got it.
So we made structures for every single song. Then I started playing to them.
So what was the stuff they replaced later?
There was some, you know, blip-blop, you know, late 80s drum, snare drummy kind of stuff, you know, that sort of went away. And the click you know, might have been like a shaker kind of thingy and that sort of thing. So if Mark was coming in to play a guitar part before I actually either replaced the drums or did the layering, he would know sort of like where the groove was. And then if Mark went on before I did, then I would sort of make decisions on sort of where he was playing, you know, the registers and that sort of thing going along with Elvis's voice. A lot of the voice was on really early, you know, so we luckily got to play to Elvis's guitar and his voice quite a bit.
Yeah, the production of that album is kind of interesting because when T-Bone did King of America, it was very sort of stripped down. And right. I remember especially right. after Goodbye Cruel World, which was the previous record he'd done with The Attractions, which really is a terrible sounding record with like Yamaha DX7 all over the place. And it's just, right. I mean, there's like no energy on that record at all. Like the songs are actually not that bad, but just the feel of it is. And so King of America was such a breath of fresh air. And then Spike reteams them, but you could see that they're sort of adding more stuff on. They're like, all right, we're going to get like into these other textures. And mm-hmm. a lot of it is the percussion. And right. some of it also is like, it's the late 80s. So the drums on This Town do have that late 80s sound. Whereas, you know, something like Let 'Em Dangle doesn't particularly.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, one of the things, it's funny that I'm not surprised that you know, thought about This Town, because Keltner had made passes at This Town. I had made passes at This Town, and T-Bone and Elvis weren't really happy with anybody. You know, I mean, not good or bad, but it's just, it didn't necessarily make the track sound better to them. You know, so what ended up happening was that they decided to go with the synth drums for better or worse. And then I could add, you know, the splings and splongs and the extra melodies and the whooshes and all that other stuff. And actually, a This Town moment for me, another kid pinched me, was that I got to spend the day with Roger McGuinn.
Nice.
When Roger did his whole Birdsey, you know, spling splong thingy, and then the outro, you know, with the quotes and his melody stuff and everything, I got to be the one that sat, you know, in the control room with him, you know, with Kevin, you know, and work out a lot of that arrangement stuff, which was really, I mean, you know, what do? You know, everybody thinks of the beginning of, you know, Turn, 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 and there I am with the guy. And another nerd moment, he had 001 for the new version of the Roger McGuinn signature, you know, Rickenbacker 12 string.
Nice.
He had the one. You know, that
he should.
That came from, well, of course. But
if anyone's going to, but still, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I just, you know, absolutely. I mean, emotionally, he should have everything that he wants, you know, from Rickenbacker. But it just, we were lucky that he had that particular instrument. And he said, when we're finished today, I'm going to sign it and send it back to Rickenbacker because, you know, it was going to go to their museum.
Oh, well, that was nice.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool because he's got those chimey tones in his guitar on that song.
Yes.
And then you're playing
yes.
the bells on there.
Yep.
And it's a great combination. And, you know, I recently went back to Spike, probably before I talked to Mark. And This Town started, I'm just like, ugh, this drum sound. So I was like, those synthesized drums that do not, like, that does not age well, I don't think. It's a good, great song, but it's sort of the weirdness of that time of that record is that some of it sounds organic and some of it's like,
No, I agree with that. I mean, Roger, who was T-Bone's main drum programmer at that point, you know, with a lot of his records, you know, setting up the structures and the beds and the setting the tempos and stuff. I mean, he was a really good guy. But the actual sounds, I mean, again, we wanted to replace as much of that stuff. I mean, it wasn't like I walked into every song being like really super duper programmed either. I mean, some of the stuff was just like a cross stick and the BPMs and a little shaker kind of thingy. I mean, a lot of it wasn't necessarily really bad Los Angeles synth drums, but that one was.
So, and then you went out on the road as part of the Rude Five touring that record. What was that like?
And
they had Pete Thomas on drums for that tour, I think.
It was fantastic. I mean, Elvis and Pete are so great. I mean, they're combined at the hip and Pete's amazing, you know, 70s to now power pop, and the way he moves everything with his hi-hat just like perfectly placed, and that energy is so good. So that was really great. But Elvis didn't necessarily want sort of like the country rock band that he had with the Confederates, you know, with James. But well, that's not sort of true. It was a bit of a hybrid band because, like, Pete from The Attractions, like you said, was on drums. Jerry Sheff, you know, from bassist. Elvis Presley and King of America and the original Confederates was on bass. And Stephen Soles was on singing background, and he'd worked with Dylan and T-Bone for like a million years. And then Mark on guitar and Larry Knechtel on piano. And that was another one of those moments where it was really an amazing experience. We fucking killed it. I mean, every time we came out on stage, we just like were on it. It was sort of like that Attractions energy where it's just like, here we come. You know, absolutely. Even when Elvis would play solo in the middle, it's just so much engagement and so much energy coming off the stage. But yeah, it was sort of like the Attractions meets Tom Waits meets King of America kind of sounds, you know, so Mark could go back and forth and then sort of, he could almost be like James Burton, but then he could, you know, be like Steve Cropper, and then he could be by himself, you know, by like himself, depending on the song. And another sort of fanboy thing with Larry Knechtel on piano. I mean, you know, Larry's background, right? Larry Knechtel was one of the Wrecking Crew stalwarts, right, you know, with Hal Blaine and Leon Russell and stuff. So among other things, God bless him, late great Larry Knechtel, he was the bass on bass on Tambourine Man. You know, the dun, dun, dun.
I did not know that.
That's Larry Knechtel.
Okay.
And also Bridge Over Troubled Water, the gospel piano, that's Larry Knechtel. And the guitar solo on Guitar Man with Bread, that's Larry Knechtel. And I knew all of that stuff. So with him getting in the Route 5, I was just like, this is like the best band in the world.
Was there any thought of, oh, you know, he's toured with the Attractions so much, we need to, you know, we need to make sure nobody's missing the Attractions out here, because it's unusual for Elvis to be touring with a band that's not the Attractions, aside from the Confederates thing, which was kind of its own thing. Because you're playing Attraction songs on that tour.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe that was the beginning of Elvis. I mean, I can't speak for him, but maybe it was where he was looking at his... My sort of music historian self would think that maybe he was starting to look at his song book as a songbook. If you understand what I mean.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually.
You know, so his songs stood up so well melodically and story-wise and characters and the chord changes and the expectations that people had because of that amazing power pop thing that he had with Steve Naive and the Attractions and stuff. But so he could play those songs with a similar energy. You know, it wouldn't be like lame versions of Attraction songs. But then he could go into New Orleans and he could go into, you know, the softer stuff, and he could do the ballads and all that other stuff with the same band.
You did some Sam Phillips stuff. You were on, what was it,
with
Cruel Inventions, and with T-Bone Burnett, and Martinis and Bikinis, I think.
Yeah, I'm on a bunch of those. I think the tracks that ended up on Martinis and Bikinis were the ones that didn't get on Cruel Inventions, if I remember correctly. But yeah, T-Bone brought me in. It was the little studio at Ocean Way, where a lot of the Beach Boys stuff had been done. So I had a day plus... You know, where he actually, it was so great as a producer. He knew all my stuff because we worked on a whole bunch of records before and blah, 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 blah. So I had all my rolling cases, you know, brought in, and everything was open. And what are we going to do? And here are all the songs. And the tracks were done and the lead vocals were done. But they wanted, on Cruel Inventions, a lot of the songs, actually, if I remember correctly, this is one of the prompts that he actually gave me. He said, a few of the songs sound like they're a little lazy or they're a little slow, but I'm not going to go back and retrack everything. So can you play your percussion stuff a little on top of the beat? You know, I had the Chinese drums, I had the gongs, I had all the stuff that I'd used with Elvis on his stuff, all of the stuff I'd used with Tom Waits, but in a but using them in a different way. But it was a lot of the same instruments, like literally like 30 different tambourines and 20 different shakers. And, you know, what do we want? And, you know, how big do you want the shaker to be? You know, should the shaker run this song? You understand what I mean? You know, so he gave me the opportunity to do that. But he said, Michael, play everything on top of the beat if you can. Huh. So I'm listening in the headphones and going, you know, in the control room and like mapping out the charts and going like, fuck, you know, so I was sweating, you know, I mean, you know, because it wasn't me finding the pocket, you know, in the drums. It was Mickey Curry, I think, and Keltner and you know, some stuff. And it wasn't like, okay, I'm going to relax and sort of like stay in the pocket, you know, with the rhythm section. It was really like, I got to make all these tracks sound a little more nervous.
So a song like Go Down, which is one of my favorites from that record, mm-hmm. there's a lot of percussive elements in that. Is that yes. something that you brought to it? Like, did that have a different feel before you got on it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was, yeah, in my ultimate humility, I mean, that was me. You know, the Spanish guitar was there. T-Bone's rhythm guitar was there. The lead vocal was there. And so it was like, Michael, what do you want to do with that? So the Chinese tom-toms went first to sort of, you know, work with the main groove. And then I started adding the other stuff. And then, if I remember correctly, it might have been that Jerry Scheff put on the Hofner bass afterwards. You know, so the last overdub might have been the electric bass. Because we've talked about that afterwards. Because then he could glue his parts and his fills to the tom-tom stuff, which in his genius would then sound like we tracked it together. So, I mean, hopefully that's one of the reasons why you like that track.
That track is just fantastic. It's just, her harmonies are really cool. They've got almost this sort of Bulgarian women's choir dissonance thing going on.
And that's then, true.
But then the textures of all that percussion and melodic percussion too. It's like, it's just a head swirling kind of song like that. To me, that was always the standout from that record. So
right.
It's a great record.
Thank you.
And I love
you're very kind. That's a favor for me.
I didn't know I was being kind. I just really like it. So I liked it before I knew you. So there you go. And that was like 91. And then 92 was Magic and Loss, where you were the drummer for Lou Reed.
Right.
So how did you connect with Lou Reed?
Well, he was on my bucket list of New York people that I would love to play with, you know, in the 80s, of course. And so I had my eye and ear on him and had heard a lot of the records and seen him live and stuff. And the thing that sort of, to answer the question as closely as I can ever do that ever, would be that Elvis and Mark Rebo and I went to hear one of Lou's concerts in New York when he was on Broadway doing New York, right. the actual New York tour. So it was Rob Wasserman on bass, Mike Rathke on guitar, and Bob Medici, actually from John Cale's band, you know, old band, on drums, and with Lou. So it was a four-piece, and they were doing New York. And for me, as a drummer, and thinking sort of like about frequencies, which I always seem to talk about, it was way too much hi-hat. Bob Medici is a wonderful drummer. He swings like a motherfucker. I mean, he's really, really wonderful. So the grooves were great, but it was cymbals everywhere. You know, it was like lots of crashes and hi-hats and all kinds of stuff. And I had a hard time hearing what was interesting to me about Lou's guitars. And of course, that stuff gets into the sibilance of the singer's enunciation. So I want to go to a Lou Reed concert to hear the stories. I want to hear his characters. Lou, of course, I think wanted to, you know, God bless his soul too, wanted to play guitar. He wanted to, you know, he was a, you know, teenage guitar god, you know, on stage, you know, during the New York period, you know, he had these amazing guitar rigs. And anyway, long story longer, it was really loud. It was way the fuck too loud. And to me, you know, and I didn't, Elvis and Mark and I, you know, met them all afterwards and blah, 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 blah. But anyway, so I was thinking, I could play Lou Reed songs and leave out almost all the cymbals. And he could hear all of his groovy guitar frequencies. And he and Mike could play the guitar stuff that they want to play. And everybody would be able to hear the lyrics. I was thinking, I can do that. So I was thinking, how do I get a hold of him? And I knew I'd worked on a record with Joe Henry, the songwriter.
Right.
And his wife is Melanie Ciccone, who is Madonna's sister. And so Mel was working for a sub-label at Sire Records, you know, working with Danny Lanois and Brian Eno and stuff like that. And I knew her from working with her husband, Joe. So I asked Mel, I said, I know that Lou doesn't audition, but I would really like to call him, you know, and just put myself into the mix, you know, saying what I just said about the symbols and all that stuff. So I asked her, you know, I said, what do you think? And then she goes, okay, I'll call him. Of course, same record company. So, because he didn't know me from anybody, really. You know, so she got an okay. And so I got to call him. And he goes, wow, you know, no one ever calls me and I don't audition and blah, 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 blah. So send me a cassette, you know, of stuff that you've done that you would like me to hear. You know, so I did, you know, and it was Hal Wilner stuff. It was Allen Ginsberg stuff. It was Waits stuff. It was all kinds of different things. And then he called me back and said, I don't hear anything on this cassette in what I'm thinking of what I want the drummer to be for the next album. So thank you anyway, but no thank you. So then, as we say in therapy land, you know, no is the first step to yes, you know? And so I got the no from Lou and I was like, oh fuck, that's too bad. And then I got a call to play drums on what was going to be that next Replacements album, you know, Paul Westerberg, you know, the Replacements, the band from, you know.
Yeah. To be like the drummer on it?
Yes. Yes.
Interesting.
And the story, of course, is that the band was falling apart. And they had decided to either re-record or lose or change or however you want to put it, a lot of the original drum tracks. Because the record was almost finished.
Was that All Shook Down?
That was All Shook Down.
Okay.
So I am listed as, you know, in the overdub sort of credits, but I play drums on half the album. And so does Charlie Drayton.
Wow, I did not know that.
So for better or worse, I mean, again, you know, Paul and Tommy had to figure out how they were going to deal with that. But the how I got the gig in the first place was that Scotty Litt was the REM producer.
Right.
Was producing All Shook Down. And I had known Scotty from knowing the REM guys, and I had played with them a little bit. And Scott knew that I could sort of go back and forth between the Charlie Wattsy thing and the Tom Waitsy thing, and, you know, what would they need? So, and they wanted to bring in somebody new, you know, to sort of replace a lot of the drums, you know, before it went out that the band was going to break up or blah, 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 blah. So I went in, and the first night, of course, we went to the bar, which was the first meeting. I had all my stuff sent to the studio, and I hadn't really heard the songs. And so they were playing me a lot of the stuff, and I was listening in the headphones and making all my notes and getting drunk that night with, of course, Paul and Tommy. They were both drinking then. This was like a long time ago, like you said. So I joined the boys club, you know, after that evening. But anyway, so I went in for a couple of days and played drums to the tracks. And anyway, again, Lou was on the same record label. And Lou heard through the grapevine in New York that I was playing drums on the Replacement record on the same record label with Scotty Litt producing. So, and of course, Lou and REM were old friends. You know, so Lou called Tommy. I mean, Lou called Scotty and said, I hear Michael's playing drums and you're mixing next week. Can I come in and hear the tracks? So Lou came down to the studio and listened to the tracks that I played drums on. Scotty played them for him. And he called me right away. He said, that's it. That's exactly what I want. You're in.
Wow.
So I got to be his Charlie Watts. He had no idea that I could do that. So I was lucky. Again, I was just completely fortunate.
That's fascinating. So when you sent him all your work, was it like a lot of percussion and drums, or was it really auditioning to be the drummer for him?
It was, well, I mean, part of it to me, maybe it was because I was sort of naive, like downtown New York-y brain, you know, was that if he had seen, say, that I had written music and performed and recorded with Allen Ginsberg, that would be a good thing. You know, from his point of view, or, you know, that I had played drums and percussion, but lots of drums with Tom, like that would be a good thing, you know. And I think he appreciated that I had, that I was a musical person. But literally, if I remember correctly, he said, there's nothing that's on this tape that sounds like what I want the drums to be. So I have no, I don't know. So no, thank you.
So when you were actually making Magic and Loss, was he happy throughout what you were doing?
Oh, absolutely. We did it. We rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed at Big Mike's in New York, a famous rehearsal space in New York, which, where Lou had all of his equipment, and so did I. So we rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed, and then he was writing the songs, finishing up all the lyrics, and of course, you know, during that period, two of his friends had died. And so that was what the stories were about. And then we went into Magic Shop in New York and we did a song a day. So there were 14 songs, something like that, 12, 14 songs. And
14.
So Lou and Mike would lay down their guitar parts first because they were interlocking guitar parts, because we rehearsed it that way. Because Lou didn't want to use headphones and he didn't want to have the whole band playing loudly in the studio at the same time. So he chose to do it step by step, but with everybody there at the same time. So
but with guitars first as opposed to drums first, where a lot of people would play down the rhythm section
yes.
first.
Yes. The guitar sounds just like I thought when I heard him, you know, before when they were playing live. I was thinking Lou's really going into frequencies and the depth of reverbs and all of this like glorious guitar stuff. And he was. It was true. It was really true. So he and Mike was doing some guitar synthesizer stuff.
It's Mike Rathke who produced it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, so he had co-produced that and, you know, came in on New York and stuff. So they were really joined at the hip with their guitar playing. So anyway, that went first. No click tracks. And then Rob Wasserman put his bass part down. Lou put his lead vocal down. And then I came in.
Drums last.
No click track. No grid. No click track. No nothing. Well, the song.
Well, I hope that they were pretty consistent with their rhythms, because that would be a little tricky, I would think.
I was sweating bullets. I was absolutely sweating bullets, because I would get in there in the morning when everybody was there, just in case Lou would change his mind, you know, and want to do something else. But that isn't really what happened. So he and Mike, you know, did their thing, and I would either be in the control room listening or be outside, you know, with my notes and listening and, you know, looking through the structures and getting ready. And Robin would play, and then Lou would sing. And then, you know, they'd come out and go, like, Michael, we're ready for you. And sometimes it was 11 o'clock at night. You know, it's like, now we want to do the drums. And I was like, oh, man. I mean, I knew I could do it, but it was really scary.
Huh.
It was really, really scary, because then I had to listen to the track. I mean, a lot of people can do this. I mean, I'm not the only person that's been asked to do this, but in that particular context, I then had to memorize the flow of the track as I was listening to it, and then make my decisions about where the fills were going to be and where the groove was and what kind of backbeat was going to be. I mean, a lot of the stuff is really simple, but I was making those decisions like in my mind, how I was going to approach, you know, the song. And then, you know, hit record and go.
Were there any of the songs that were a little wobbly in their execution and you had to kind of work around it?
Yes. Let me just put it that way. The answer is yes.
When you emphasized no click tracks, that kind of implied that, you know, they're winging it a little bit. So,
absolutely.
I mean, there's something beautiful about, like, not having click tracks. But usually I would think you'd not have the click track, but do the lay down the drums not last.
Right. Some years before that and many, many years after that, since it was quite a long time ago, I've been asked to come in and put in drums and or percussion layering after a track is done. And so I would have a lead vocal to work with, and I knew where the solos were and the dynamics and stuff, so I could make good decisions. But that was now, especially in the 21st century, that's always with a grid, and it's always non-destructive, you know, as far as the recording goes. You know, it's not on tape. You know, so all kinds of things can be moved around and changed and redecided, you know, and I'm still on last. But the decision-making process and the technology is completely different. And then for my ego and for Lou's respect out of Lou's place in the music ecosystem, you know, in making that record for him, I never wanted him to go home not having a drum track finished.
Right.
If you understand what I mean. So we were all there in the morning, and then well after dinner, it's like, okay, Michael, we're ready for the drums. And that could be like nighttime. It could be like, we should really be going to bed soon time. And then I would go in and I would go, I'm never gonna let Mike and Lou go home wondering if they had the track finished.
Right.
So
that's, you know, a lot of pressure.
It was an incredible amount of pressure, but it worked. It seemed to work. I mean, then we'd come in the next day and Lou would go like, we're good. You know, next song.
So the song Magic and Loss is the last song on the record. And right. Toward the end of that song, you get this really nice kind of eruption, climax, right. Cacophony. Yes. Was that one of the last songs you recorded? And B, like, how did that come to be?
I think it probably, I don't think we recorded in sequence. But I understand your question. It was one of the ones later on. It was one of the bigger, longer songs, for one. So being able to concentrate on that for how long it was and the different changes and the guitar synthesizers and all that other stuff. But yeah, in rehearsal, Lou made that decision that at the end it should blow up a bit. So I knew going in that I was going to have that chance.
Did you rehearse like different ways to do it, or was it just, this is just what came out and that was it?
That was just what came out, actually. I mean, we rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed, you know, so long before we actually went into the studio, that was already a musical decision, you know, that had been made in rehearsal. You know, after this point and after the vocals are over, it sort of goes up a gear. You know, then we knew that was going to happen. That wasn't spontaneous.
Yeah.
But it's supposed to sound spontaneous.
So was that positive experience overall, working with your hero Lou Reed?
It was incredible. Those stories, and also the way he was writing the, and you know, with Doc Pomus and Rita, you know, from the factory that he was basing these characterizations on. I mean, for me, as a player, you know, loving to get into an artist's storytelling and where the rhymes are and how personal the characterizations are. That's how I start making decisions. You know, when I'm working with singers who write with text, you know, the lyric writers, you know, I get way into what are they trying to mean here? And how am I going to make it as interesting as possible? You know, not just for myself, but for the artist. So every time they listen to that track, they go like, that's really what that track needed to be.
So I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to this, but did you work with him after that, or was that just the one project?
No, I didn't actually. Well, I mean, that was a new band for him, because then when we did the touring, you know, that the years later, you know, there was a rehearsal period, the recording period, the release period, and then all the touring. You know, there was the Magic and Loss touring was with me and Mike Rathke and Rob Wasserman and Lou. So it was a four-piece, except the times we also worked with Jimmy Scott. You know, Jimmy Scott was with us when we did the movie of it and did some of the New York shows and L.A. shows and stuff, singing the backup, you know, that beautiful sort of, you know, answer, response, you know, kind of stuff, you know, that he can only do with that contralto voice or whatever it's called. But yeah, so, and one of the big things for that tour was that we headlined Glastonbury on Magic and Loss.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting, so, album to do Glastonbury with.
Yeah. And I mean, when we would do the theater on that tour, we would do the theater concerts would be in two parts. So Magic and Loss, first song to last song, and then take a break, and then play the hits. You know, so some of the songs for Drella stuff, you know, that he did with John Cale, and the Andy Warhol-y stuff, the Velvet Underground stuff, and the solo stuff. You know, so it was rock and roll and Vicious and Satellite of Love, you know, and that kind of stuff in the second half. So anyway, then when we would do the stadium, when we would do, not stadiums, but when we would do the outdoor festivals, it would be like a greatest hits kind of thing, you know, with like 20 songs that included the Velvet stuff and the solo stuff and like What's Good and some of the other stuff that was coming from Magic and Loss. Right. So it wasn't just Sweet Jane for like an hour. but you know, when you were playing Glastonbury and those kinds of things, I mean, you'd have to play that stuff. And it was great. People loved it. And for me, again, you know, when I teach and stuff, I go like, I got to play Sweet Jane and Wild Side with the person who wrote it. You know, so for me as a musician, I go like, wow, you know, that it's pretty cool, you know, to be able to have done that, you know, to be able to work with the composer. It's great.
Have you known his music for so long before you actually met and worked with him? Was there anything mm-hmm. about him that particularly surprised you?
Well, one of the things that ended up happening sort of after we would get to know each other was that he actually even said that he didn't like the sound of a lot of the earlier records. And since he was really getting into guitars and frequencies and the depth of production and stuff, that a lot of his 70s stuff, you know, sounded a little thin to him. And you know, so he was interested in pursuing even still having a rock and roll band, but not having that kind of energy anymore. So that was fun. But from a personal sort of emotional point of view, one of the things that was really great, I knew Bob Quine too beforehand, and Fernando Saunders. I had played with Fernando, the bass player, and Robert Quine, the guitarist, you know, who had worked on Blue Mask, right. You know, and had known, you know, Lou forever. So I got some stories, and I knew that Lou almost always, you know, yelled at the drummer and fired them, you know, eventually, and, you know, or in the middle of tours and stuff like, so be ready and all that sort of stuff. That didn't happen to me, thank God. But then the Big Bad Lou Reed stories were usually from journalists who didn't ask very good questions, as I found out, you know, so his sort of, you know, yelling at journalists because they're stupid kind of thing. Part of it was actually really deserved as I saw him, you know, work with, you know, with some interviewers. And the personal thing for me that I'll always take with me forever is that he met Lena, my lovely, getting back to the beginning of this talk, why I ended up in Stockholm. I mean, she was hanging out with us in New York for part of the rehearsal period. She came over and, you know, we had friends and it was great. And it was good for her to be there. And for us together, it was really romantic and lovely. And she met Lou one day, and he had heard about her anyway, and we get into the car to go downtown to go to it was on the street, you know, where we met, and we had a car to go down to the rehearsals, and then in the car he looked at me and he said, "If you fuck up that marriage, I'm going to kill you." And I was like, this is Big Bad Lou Reed talking about my lovely Swedish partner. This is like the best thing ever.
That's sweet. That's funny.
Yeah, it really was.
I still want to ask you about the impact of working with Hal Willner.
The Rain Dogs summer changed everything as far as my being perceived as being an interesting musician, I think. So I was lucky that way. But that's where I also met Hal. I mean, I'd known about the Nina Rota record, you know, that he had done, I think, was with what, Debbie Harry and Peter Frampton and Donald Fagen, and, you know, like one of the first theme, you know, records that he had done, the multi-artist theme records. And so I was aware of him. But we recorded what Keeps Mankind Alive, you know, a Bertolt Brecht piece with the Tom Waits Rain Dogs Band, you know, so for his Lost in the Stars record, you know, that had Lou and Sting and a lot of other people. You know, it was another multi-artist record, so I knew who he was. But he came to the studio, and we made an arrangement of that song, of that track, for Tom Waits's contribution to the Bertolt Brecht, you know, album that, that Hal was producing. So I got to know him then, because he came in, you know, we did that song in a day, and then we just kept in touch. And of course, Hal was really happy to, you know, he knew the Lounge Lizards, and he got to know Mark, and you know, was a big fan of Waits and Kathleen's writing, and so we kept in touch. So then he started asking me to come in to work on his records.
Were those special experiences for you, just working on those?
I mean, Hal's unfortunately long dead from COVID and stuff like that, but I would have kept on. If I had lived in New York, I would have just wanted to play on every single thing he ever did. I mean, what did I end up doing? It was Weird Nightmare, the Meditations on Mingus, the Charles Mingus, a multi-artist record. I was in the house band for that.
Were you on Stay Awake?
I played on a lot of the tracks on Stay Awake. I was Mr., you know, the what do we need for orchestral percussion guy, you know, on that record. So that was fun. And all of the Allen Ginsberg stuff that he had done at the time, you know, The Line for Real. I wrote some of that music and helped arrange all of it, and with Mark as well. And I did a theater project with Hal in Copenhagen a number of years ago, you know, a long time ago, actually, with Robert Wilson, the avant-garde theater director. You know, so I was lucky. Yeah, I mean, Hal's trust in me changed the way I could make music. I mean, I found somebody that understood my decision-making process, and I understood his. You know, so we didn't always end up with a solution that worked all the time, you know, from moment to moment. It was never like, again, do whatever you want. But for me as an artist, as a percussionist and thinking drummer and that sort of thing, working with Hal was a goldmine. It was a creative period that also helped change the way, I think, for Mark as well. You know, for almost everybody who was working on Hal Wilner records, the people that really loved those records knew who we all were. You know, so that changed everything for me as well.
Nice. And then to backtrack to 87, when you did Frank's Wild Years,
right?
You were part of the live show at Steppenwolf in Chicago,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. What was that experience like?
It was wonderful. I mean, it was sort of the Rain Dogs-y band, but Mark Rebo wasn't available that summer. So we got Morris Tepper, or Tom and Kathleen got Morris Tepper from Captain Beefheart's band. So that was a good choice. And Greg Cohen played bass, and Willie Schwartz played. No, it was Bill Schimmel played accordion, and he played almost all the accordion on Rain Dogs as well. So yeah, I mean, we rehearsed in Chicago. We moved there. I mean, everybody basically moved there for that summer. And we rehearsed all the songs, I think partly in New York and partly in Chicago, and then heavy rehearsals with the Steppenwolf Theater Company. You know, for readers that don't know about them, I mean, that's where John Malkovich came from, that's where Terry Kinney came from, that's where Laura Linney, I think, came from, Gary Sinise, you know,
Metcalf.
Or Laurie Metcalf, right, exactly. And so an incredible amount of, you know, from your city, you know, some of the best actors in my generation. Absolutely. You know, so we were lucky to do that. And Gary Cole, you know, who's been on NCIS, you know, for all these years,
sure,
as well. He was, you know, so the Frank's Wild Years characters on that particular project were played by, they were played by completely different people. So instead of Tom being seven different people on the record, which he ended up being, you know, there were actually seven different humans, you know, being all of these different characters,
right,
you know, in the songs. But it was amazing. It was Ralph Carney, again, bless his soul, one of the coolest multi-instrumentalist saxophonists that you could ever want to be around. I mean, crazy, you know, like a loon. But on the other hand, some of the best post Coltrane, you know, saxophone sounds that I've ever heard, you know, and so we were really lucky.
You get a good feel for the city's cultural scene while you were here?
No, I did. I stayed. I mean, almost everybody else left, and I stayed for almost a year afterwards. I got an apartment and on the, you know, close to the water, and a lot of my friends were there, like from Geffen Records, and then, you know, people that you probably know, like Moira McCormick, and
sure,
then Michael Nayman, you know, who works with Greg Kot, you know, and that sort of thing when he was the music director at Harper College, and Nick Tremulous. You know, I had met Nick Tremulous and his band, actually. I played percussion on some of Nick's early stuff when he was on Island Records, you know, because of the Tom Waits connection. You know, and then, of course, when I was in Chicago for all those years, I got to hang out with Nick all the time.
Nice. And you knew Nan Warshaw from...
Absolutely. Warshaw, I met Nan after that. But yeah, Nan and Mark, you know, are really good friends. Actually, here's another story. It was like Nan Warshaw that introduced me to Ryan Adams, which is, you know, because Ryan was on Bloodshot then.
Right.
You know, and I got to work on a bunch of tracks with Ryan, you know, so... I get lucky that people don't mind introducing me to other people. I'm very fortunate that people trust me, that I won't fuck up their reputations.
So what are you working on now?
The sort of paying the bill stuff is I'm working, well, partly because it's just 21st century Stockholm. Music tech startups are huge here right now, you know. So, I mean, the Skype started here, Spotify started here, SoundCloud started here, Mojang and Candy Crush, you know, the gaming company started here. So, in the air, everybody wants to be a music tech, you know, entertainment tech entrepreneur. Again, because of my background in teaching and that sort of thing, I'm coaching young entrepreneurs who are doing startups, you know, creative identity, texture, websites, communication, speaking in public. You know, so I'm working as a coach. I'm working as a consultant, you know, with some really interesting young, you know, music tech, you know, wizards. So that's really fun. And then also I'm starting some new projects that are based on sustainability, environmental, social activism, two new friends of mine that are from the Stockholm University and also from the Nobel Prize outreach committee. And it's a thing called Strange Attractors. And it's directly collaborating with the Kronos String Quartet from San Francisco.
Right.
You know, they're the avant-garde string quartet of the last 50 years and stuff like that. So they're working with indigenous composers, photographers, and building new and old songs based on nature, collaboration, longevity, that kind of thing. I mean, it seems sort of long-winded, but it's still in sort of my wheelhouse about storytelling. So I'm becoming one of their music advisors, you know, in their new projects.
Nice. Do you get out and perform?
Very little. Very little. I mean, for one, I'm a little older and I've got grandkids now, you know, so maybe I don't want to be away from the babies, you know, the way I used to be. And also the idea of working on some of these projects is sort of like legacy things for how I present myself as an artist and as a creative person. It's good for me to be in Stockholm, you know, to be able to work on these things, because the level of people that are working here now is really high. So I feel very lucky to be here at this point. Years ago, I was working with a really great songwriter in Norway. I got recommended for a big project with him. So I spent a year, you know, developing his music, and I was the first drummer he had ever had. And he got in, you know, a million awards. And also when Hugh Laurie, the actor Hugh Laurie, when he put his first live band together, I was in that. You know, because again, back to Joe Henry, you know, whose wife, you know, Mel, you know, got me in touch with Lou. Joe had produced the original Hugh Laurie blues piano albums, you know, because when Hugh was doing House, you know, the TV show, he was also making these blues records. He's a great piano player. So when they first put their first live band together, I was recommended for that. So point being, every once in a while, I'll get a phone call that I can't refuse.
Do people call you and say, hey, come to New York or LA and record on this album for a few weeks or months or whatever?
Not anymore, really. I certainly wish they did. But almost everybody I know in New York and LA are have the same sort of, oh, woe is me. You know, there aren't as many things like that, you know, and so no, actually. Well, what ends up happening now is that people will send me tracks on Pro Tools or Logic.
Right.
And then I'll go into a studio and do my thing based on their prompts or my relationship with them and or, you know, rehearsals or, you know, talking about what the project is. Because I've done a bunch of stuff for songwriters from London in the last years. You know, my UK thing, I've got three or four artists call me when they make records and they send me stuff. You know, so that's really nice. I'm happy for that.
Cool. Well, this was a real treat for me, and I'm really glad we made this happen. And thank you for talking with me about all this. These are fantastic stories, and I'm really, really glad we got to do this.
Well, thank you for your patience, and I'm with you on the Chicago Connection, and it was a real pleasure.
That's all for episode 213 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Michael Blair for opening our ears to all the cool work he has done over the years. Check out Tom Waits' Rain Dogs, Elvis Costello's Spike, Sam Phillips' Cruel Inventions, and Lou Reed's Magic and Loss for starters. For information about Blair's creativity coaching for startups and organizations, as well as his percussion playing, go to his LinkedIn page. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who never lets me be misunderstood. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop, including Matthew Krasnowski. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative, and I'll give you a shout-out on the next episode. Please go to carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro, at M-A-R-K-C-A-R-O. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube. Tell your friends and return next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.